Hello and welcome back to the Let's Talk Palestine podcast. Today we're going to be doing the deep dive into Palestinian history, everything from the very inception over, well, around 100 years ago. And we're doing this to give you all the context you would need really to really understand everything about Palestine, to understand the Palestinian psyche, to really be able to navigate your way through discourse regarding Palestine, really. I won't be alone. I'll be joined again by Ferdis.
Hey, guys.
So I guess the best way to start is just simply to ask, when exactly and specifically which events have to kind of be considered to be the origin to the plight of the Palestinian people that we see today?
Yeah, so if we could boil down the last 100 plus years of this history to one point, then I would really say that it all started in the early 1880s. And I think it's really important to start there, because a lot of people, you know, they start, with 1948. Some people are a bit more educated. They'll say 1917, which is when the Balfour Declaration was issued. And if you don't know what that is, that's completely fine. We'll get to it very shortly. But if you really want to get back to where it is, then it really is in the 1880s, because at that point is when the movement that we now call Zionism started emerging. I guess we should set the scene for what was happening in the 1880s. So in the 1880s, Palestine was under the Ottoman Empire. And the Palestinians there, like many other people around the world, because this was a global phenomenon, were beginning to develop ideas of nationalism, and they were beginning to develop these ideas that, okay, we need to gain control over our own destiny, over our own country, to not be subject to, you know, foreign empires who might mistreat us, which was beginning to happen in the 1800s. And at the same time, all the way in Austria, in Europe, I'm pretty sure it was Vienna, you had this man called Theodor Herzl, a Jewish Austrian man who was actually atheist, and he believed that because of all the rising anti-Semitism that was happening in Europe, that the only solution wasn't, you know, assimilation. It wasn't learning, you know, addressing the anti-Semitism in Europe. He thought it was a lost cause. And so what he said was, listen, we will never be safe if we are a minority, right? If we are a minority capable of being marginalized or persecuted or discriminated against, as was happening in Europe, then he said, we'll never be safe. And so what we really need is we need to become like the European countries. We need our own Jewish national homeland in which no other group can threaten us. Now, the problem was that there was no place like this in the world. And he was well aware of that. And so, you know, this movement he founded called Zionism, through the 80s and the 90s and the very early 1900s, up until 1904, and I'll explain what happened in that year. But in this time period, they were searching for a place to establish this Jewish homeland. And not a lot of people know this, but Palestine wasn't the only place they considered. They considered Argentina, and actually in the 90s, certain Jewish colonies were even established in the parts of Argentina already. They were just later dismissed after they chose Palestine. The British formally and officially offered in 1904, they offered Kenya, parts of Kenya, and they called it the Uganda Plan, but it's part of Kenya, not Uganda today. They offered it to the Zionists, and the Zionists, by a very slim margin, eventually voted no. They offered parts of Egypt and the Sinai Peninsula, and they even considered parts of Cyprus. But ultimately, they chose Palestine because of its Jewish heritage and, you know, the historic connections with Judaism and the Jewish people. But the problem was that, you know, Alessandro, me and our families were there, as were all these other Palestinians. And at the time, the Palestinian people, a majority, around 80-something percent, were Muslim. Between 10 to 15% were Christian, and then you had a small minority, 3%, were Jewish.
I mean, one of the Zionist talking points is always that this was a land without people for a people without a land. And I mean, we've just established, as you said, that this clearly wasn't the case. There was a Palestinian population there, even containing Jewish people. It's not a contradiction to say a Palestinian Jew. But I mean, this was also recognized by these early Zionist leaders. I think you had a quote from one
of the writers, one of the Zionist writers called Ahad Ha'am. I don't know how to pronounce his name, but he wrote, and we still have these entries that he wrote. He basically said that all these early Jewish settlers and colonists that were arriving in Palestine were completely mistreating the Arabs. They were beating them. They looked down at them as savages. And he warned the Zionist leaders that, listen, if you think that we will take over their country and they're not going to do anything about it, then you're gravely mistaken, right? And he warned them that, you know, it's still a racist statement to what he said, but I guess, you know, you have to compare to the rest of the Zionists. I guess he's somewhat progressive. He essentially said, listen, the Arabs aren't as dumb as you think. They're not as weak as you think. You know, and he referred to them as the Arabs, not as the Palestinians, because they very much strongly rejected any recognition of Palestinians as their own people, right? Palestinians were viewed as this random assortment of Arabs who just happened to be in Palestine and who weren't attached at all to this land, who had no unique identity, and who could easily just be expelled to other Arab countries like Egypt and Syria and Iraq, and, you know, they wouldn't even protest. They wouldn't even be mad about it, which is ludicrous. But the idea stands is Zionism said that we need to establish a country here, and that country needs to only be for one people, for one ethnic group, and that's for the Jewish people. So it wasn't at all like they were coming here to join the Palestinians, to you know, partner up with them. Not at all. There was a tiny minority of Zionists who believed in that, and they were very much marginalized and dismissed.
So did the Zionist movement get any traction outside of kind of these Zionist circles? Did it get any state actors? Did anybody support this movement?
In 1917, Britain issued something called the Balfour Declaration. Now, it's called Balfour because the foreign secretary at the time was it William Balfour?
Arthur Balfour, I think.
Arthur, exactly. Perfect. Yeah. Thank you. Arthur Balfour. And if you can look up what this declaration was. It was a very short letter. Anyone can Google this and find this right now. And it was essentially a British promise to establish a Jewish homeland in Palestine. And what's really striking about it is he makes absolutely no mention of any Palestinian national rights. In fact, he doesn't even mention Palestinians by name. He doesn't even refer to them as, you know, the generic Arabs, which is erasure enough, but he doesn't even do that. How does he call them? He calls them the non-Jews there. So he defines them in relation to not being Jewish. And he, you know, the letter, at first glance, you might think, well, the letter says they're going to protect the civil rights of the non-Jews, of the Palestinians. The problem is that there's no mention of national rights. In other words, it would be completely fine if Palestinians had all their civil rights, but had absolutely no national identity, no rights as a group, a right to belong to their land, to their identity. And that's really, you know, Britain really sets the stage here, as it has around much of the world, for making it a much worse place in that period. And so, of course, this sparks a lot of anger among the Palestinians, and that anger only increases in 1919, when Britain takes over Palestine. It occupies Palestine after the Ottoman Empire falls.
No, I just wanted to quickly add also, because I think what's sometimes quite important to mention is that the British government had already been in contact with the people of the Middle East, let's say more generally, and what is known as kind of the Hussein McMahon correspondence, which was basically the British in their classic ways of saying, if you rebel against your current occupiers, we will then grant you freedom and everything you would ever want. Obviously, as Palestinians found out later on, and as many other people groups around the world, whether it be Indian people in South Asia, Pakistani people, or Kurdish people, even closer to the Middle East, and other people in the Levant. This was never going to be the case, because also at the same time, the British and the French were coordinating on how best to divide the Middle East so that they can each have their or maximize their interests, let's say.
Absolutely, absolutely. I wish we had even more time for this podcast, because, I mean, to be honest, all of this is such a simplified overview. And actually, the goal is for all our listeners to, you know, walk away from this episode with answers, but also a lot more questions, because, you know, we're trying to smush together 100 years in this one episode, which is quite difficult to do. But you're absolutely right. It, you know, the British promise was in the context of the Sykes-Picot agreement just 1 year before Balfour, which is basically a deal where the French and the British said, listen, let's divide the Middle East between us. And what's really funny is that deal itself was made after, as you said, a deal made between the British and the Arabs, that if the Arabs overthrow the Ottomans, there will be an independent Arab state across most of the Middle East, which obviously didn't happen. But now that we're under the British, now that the British have arrived in Palestine, that's when we really see the Zionist movement begin to strengthen. So the Zionist movement, since the year 1904, when they kind of officially decided on Palestine, and, you know, I kind of neglected to mention, but they did have all these institutions. They had something called the World Zionist Organization, which technically still exists, just not as important anymore. They had annual Zionist congresses, that's what they called them. And one of these congresses in 1904, they finally decided on Palestine. That's what we're going to colonize now. And actually, I want to just stop here for a moment on the word colonize. It's a completely objective term, and it's a bit surprising that people don't use it as much. It's good that an increasing number of historians now use it today. But the Zionist movement very much saw itself as colonial, and very proudly so. In one of their first congresses, they concluded with a practical program that called for three things. And those three things were organization, colonization, and negotiation. They had something called the Jewish Colonial Trust, which was what provided most of the funding for these settlements. Theodor Herzl, who had died in 1904, either 4, 5, or 6. I don't really concern myself with when exactly he dropped dead. But he, a few years before he did, he wrote to Cecil Rhodes, the British officer who was in charge of colonizing Zimbabwe at the time, which he called Rhodesia, and established a form of apartheid, actually. He wrote to Cecil Rhodes and said that you need to support Zionism because it is quintessentially something colonial, like what you're doing in Zimbabwe. And there are many more examples that we can give. I'd really advise people to look through our post about Zionism and about Zionism as settler colonialism on our Instagram page. Point is, they started to establish settlements under the Ottoman Empire. When the British came, they could now flourish, because the British were very openly and explicitly in support of the Zionist movement. And it was under their watch in the 20s, 30s, and 40s that they allowed more and more Jewish settlers to come and to arrive in Palestine.
And kind of just to interject quickly, I'm just to clarify again, would you say that because of Britain's inherent being at the time of being a colonial power, that's why you would say that they supported the Zionist project?
That's an interesting question. I would say there are a few different factors for why Britain supported the Zionist movement, which you're right, I didn't actually explain why they did that. So one of the main reasons is that the British public at the time, there was this very prominent Christian belief that the return of the Jewish people to, you know, the so-called Holy Land would usher in the return of the Messiah. The other reason was simply because of just plain old anti-Semitism in Britain, because the anti-Semites realized that if, you know, the more Jewish people are in Palestine, the less Jewish people there are in Britain. And that's what these anti-Semitic people wanted. And so, in fact, you know, Balfour himself was a rampant anti-Semite. And the only Jewish, the only Jewish MP in Britain at the time.
So
he fiercely opposed Zionism and the Balfour Declaration, calling out several of these reasons. And the third point for why Britain supported Zionism was because they viewed it as a helpful ally to implant into the Middle East to serve its interests, which is essentially the US's relationship with Israel now. But at the time, it was with the UK. And you need to put this into context of, like you said, Britain was very much an empire at the time, a fully fledged empire. And they actually really wanted control of Palestine and, you know, the broader Middle East to cement their control of India. Because, you know, the Middle East is in between them. If they don't have control of that, it's much harder to control and send supplies to India and to your army and maintain it. And in that sense, the colonization of India and Palestine were very much intertwined from British perspective. So let's get back to the 20s. Under British control, increased Jewish settlement. And when I say increased Jewish settlement, I think it's important for people to understand what does that actually mean. Because you really need to put it in the context of what happens when colonists and settlers arrive in the country of a native people. And this has happened in history from the Native Americans, the indigenous people in Turtle Island, South Africa, to the Aboriginals in what is now called Australia, and of course in Palestine. When settlers come, they forcibly take up land. They're not like immigrants who join a society to participate in that society. These were settlers who established racially segregated settlements and colonies in Palestine, in which they used to take and confiscate land from the Palestinians. And so in this period already, people talk about the ethnic cleansing that's been happening since 1948, and that's very important. That is the bulk of the ethnic cleansing. What they don't realize that this ethnic cleansing, the process, really started all the way back to the late 1800s and began here to accelerate now under British control in the 20s and the 30s. More racially segregated settlements, more expulsion of Palestinians, more violence against Palestinians who were constantly denied any political rights.
Just to clarify then at that point, just to make it very clear, like, it was a very real problem of anti-Semitism in Europe. And so that in no way, I don't think, would we ever like try to deny that this was an issue. Like, this was a real issue. However, the solution that was being floated around by not only early Zionist Jewish people such as Herzl, but also the governments of Europe, who kind of saw it as a tool to further their own interests. Two wrongs don't make a right at the end of the day. And the colonization of another land simply because of your own problems is, just to make it very clear, is not a good solution.
Absolutely not. And that's really one of the most insidious parts of this, is that a lot of the Jewish refugees who were fleeing persecution in Europe, very real, very anti-Semitic, very unacceptable persecution, what they were essentially being subjected to is that they were being transformed into settlers in Palestine. And so the Zionist movement and its European allies, namely Britain at the time, were really forcing these Jewish refugees to only be safe at the expense of another people. And I do want to clarify that this doesn't mean that every single Zionist was innocent. No, absolutely not. At the end of the day, the whole movement was established and led and constantly, you know, led by Jewish people, by Jewish colonists. But it's just that of the population of settlers, some of them were very willing and were very enthusiastic and very much did have a choice in coming here, but others weren't. And their victimhood and vulnerability was weaponized against Palestinians. And a lot you can still say about that today.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. It's this whole weaponization is something that hasn't gone away, and just playing on people's fears. And again, that's really a classic colonial strategy of, again, making the person next to you seem like it's the real issue, whereas the person above you, i.e. the British and the people from the West who were creating all the problems and pitting people against one another, that's kind of the real issue.
Absolutely. And so, you know, during this time, as Palestinian national sentiment was also increasing and was beginning to understand how much of a threat it was facing, this ultimately started obviously boiling down to tensions. And so, you know, new leadership was emerging. As early as 1919, you had very official Palestinian national leadership. And, you know, it culminated with the what was called at the time the Arab Higher Committee for Palestine. And in 1936, this all really, you know, came to a boiling point when the Palestinians staged a massive rebellion against the British. And this was called some called the Great Arab Revolt, some called the Great Palestinian Revolt, some would even call it the first ever Palestinian Intifada. And so what it really was, it lasted from 1936 to 1939, and it was Palestinians just saying, listen, we're fed up, we've tried to negotiate, we've peacefully protested, we've sent our delegations to the, you know, the Paris Peace Conference, to all your little conferences, and none of it's working, and we know you're never going to concede because of how many interests you have, so we need to force you, so we need to really properly put pressure. And so in these 3 years, the British crackdown was massive. It was massive. In these 3 years, 10% of the Palestinian adult male population was either killed, injured, imprisoned, or exiled, fully expelled from Palestine. And that's a massive number, really, especially just over the course of only 3 years.
Can I just touch on the brutality of it as well? Because I think what recently, or maybe by now it's been over a year since I started reading some reports of basically Palestinians being kept in barbed wire cages, basically, mm-hmm. And being left there for days, sometimes without being given any food or any drink from the British, well, colonizers, basically, who were imprisoning them there. These were all tactics which were kind of very widely used across the British Empire, which, I mean, now is just a quick side point, but which is why, for example, there's so much solidarity from Ireland, because all the tactics that were implemented in Ireland were also implemented in Palestine. And so that's why it's also a bit of a brotherly cause, so to say.
Absolutely. I think even, you know, the Black and Tans, who, you know, the British policing, controlling force in Ireland at the time of the Irish struggle for independence, they were sent to Palestine themselves as early as the 1920s. And in fact, you even had Irish newspapers and, you know, politicians and freedom fighters at a time who were very openly identifying their struggle with the Palestinians as one against colonization and for, you know, the sovereignty and autonomy of the native people of the lands of these countries.
But I just also like just to expand a bit as well, because you've mentioned a bit about the Palestinian uprising, the rebellion, the revolt. But it wasn't, I mean, just to kind of make it the build up of it all a bit clearer as well. It was just, whilst the British were in Palestine, they were allowing the Zionist settlers to flourish and to develop into an independent nation at one point, obviously part of the Balfour Declaration, whilst suppressing the Palestinian population that lived side by side with them, basically. And that's specifically, it's kind of maybe even one of the early forms of apartheid, but implemented by a third power, so to say. And that's kind of why this anger was rising and, as you said, reached boiling point in 1936.
Absolutely. There very much was this very open discrimination, because the Jewish settlers at the time, they were very much allowed to develop all these institutions. They were very much allowed to develop a sort of even legislature, a sort of parliament for themselves. Meanwhile, when the Palestinians tried establishing their own parliament in, I believe it was the 30s, it was very much very quickly shut down by the British, who didn't tolerate it one bit. But it was also really important at the time, the 1936 Palestinian Revolution, because that's kind of when we see the birth of a fully fledged Palestinian struggle. That was very much coordinated, had leadership, and had very clear tactics. So they took direct military action, you know, armed resistance operations against both British and Zionist military targets, because I actually think we failed to mention it so far, Alejandro, but the Zionists weren't just allowing the British to be the only military force there, the Zionists had established their own militias and their own armed groups that were now patrolling Palestine and, you know, very much ensuring that nobody can challenge this colonial project.
Terrorist groups, just to...
In other words,
let's...
definitely terrorist groups in every sense of the meaning. In fact, these Zionist militias were the first, some of the first to introduce what are common terrorist tactics today in the Middle East with, you know, the indiscriminate bombings of, you know, places of crowds and all these things. That was very much introduced to the Middle East by these Zionist militias. And so when in 1936 the Palestinians all revolted, not only was there this, you know, the armed resistance operations, but there was also mass mobilization with all among all Palestinians. It led to a nationwide strike that brought the economy to its knees. And it even mobilized these initiatives to replace British colonial structures and institutions with independent Palestinian institutions like courts and postal service. And try to create, you know, economic self-sufficiency so that they no longer have to rely on the British. And so at the time, this whole revolution, there was one main goal, a temporary goal at least, a short-term goal, which was to stop more Jewish settlement. Because, you know, the Jewish settler population at the time in Palestine was... well, I can't remember, but it was multiplying by magnitudes of order, right? It was tripling, quadrupling over certain periods from the beginning of the 1900s. And it was getting to a point where, you know, the amount of Palestinian displacement was multiplying year on year. It was increasing. And so the revolution actually succeeded in the short term in forcing the British to adopt something called the White Paper, which was essentially a pledge to limit the quota of Jewish settlers who arrived to come and enter the colonies in Palestine.
I just want to add just a quick point to that, because I think, well, when we reach sort of the climax of anti-Semitism in Europe being sort of the start of the Second World War, mid to late 30s, start of the 40s, a lot of the migration of Jewish people, a lot of the people fleeing anti-Semitism in Europe was actually headed towards the US. But just to make a point here again, the US actually limited Jewish migration into the US partly because they wanted everybody to go to Palestine instead, to become sort of, as we've mentioned now, this outpost in the Middle East that can secure Western interests.
I think that's actually quite a good segue into this way that we can understand how Zionism reached the stage that it's reaching right now in the 30s and the 40s, you know, in the timeline that we're talking about. And I think, you know, we've done a post on this, and I really highly recommend people check it out. It's called Why Zionism Needed the Nakba. And what this essentially talks about is, why did Zionism decide to commit the ethnic cleansing that it had been committing at this stage, but then really started to pick up on it in 1948 and afterwards until today, until right now as we speak? And what's really important for people to understand is that it's not an accident. It's not the decision of a few bad leaders, of a few evil leaders. But it's very much fundamental to what Zionism is. And so we got to kind of go back to when we were saying that Zionism really needs to ensure that no other group can threaten the Jewish people in this homeland, in the state that they are trying to establish, that they are trying to create. Because what does that actually mean? You know, it sounds nice, like, you know, when you say it in theory, oh, we don't want any other group to threaten us. That sounds quite normal, doesn't it? But when you're establishing it in the context of a land that already has another people there, people who've been living there for thousands of years, who are the rightful owners of this land, then there's only really one way that you can ensure that they don't have the political power to threaten you. And Zionism was very much, and still is, obsessed with this idea of demographic majority. It's this idea that, listen, if there are more of us than there are of them, then we'll be fine. We can manage any threats, right? The threats will be small enough for us to imagine, we'll be fine. And, you know, this idea had been discussed among the Zionist leadership for a very long time. As early as Theodor Herzl wrote about in the 1890s in Der Judenstaat, in his German publication titled The State of the Jews, and where he basically said that, you know, the expulsion of the native population needs to be, of the poor, as he called it, needs to be efficient. And before we build a new state, we need to demolish the old one, right? To build a new country, we need to demolish the old one. And at the time, he was talking about both Palestine and Argentina, which were his two top options. And so this idea had been discussed for a long time, but it wasn't actually until 1937, a year after the revolution started, when the British, again, introduced an amazing idea that couldn't go wrong, of course, as we know is the case with the British. They released something called the Peel Commission Plan and had a bunch of recommendations on what to do with Palestine. None of these recommendations, of course, included how about, you know, we care about the Palestinians and fulfill all their, you know, essential human and national rights. Instead, they said, how about we divide Palestine, but because we know that, you know, and let's divide Palestine into a Jewish state and a Palestinian state. But they said, because we know that dividing it into a Jewish state would give such little land, then we propose essentially, you know, forcibly transferring around 100,000 Palestinians from certain areas so that these areas can be given to the Jewish state.
I just want to make a quick little parallel to today, kind of like fast forward, because often we see in conversations about Israel that the problems now are because Israel is such a polarized country, it's very left or very right. And the truth is this doesn't matter at all, because Israel was very left-wing at the beginning. And like, it doesn't matter when you look at Israeli leaders, whether it is a left-wing or right-wing. The problem, as we've just kind of mentioned and we've just tried to explain to you, is that Israel is fundamentally and inherently Zionist. This Zionist ideology is connected to its very core with the displacement and the dispossession of Palestinians.
Exactly. There's this very misguided, or at least maybe delusional, belief that the problem is just Netanyahu. The problem is these new far-right Israeli ministers who've entered. And, you know, don't get me wrong, these guys are to the bone.
Insane.
But they're only insane really in their honesty and in how bad their PR is. But in terms of their actual beliefs, here you have, you know, if an Israeli leader today came out and said, we need to expel 100,000 Palestinians against their will, which they are actually saying, they're saying much worse. You know, you have very prominent Israeli leaders right now, politicians saying that they need to ethnically cleanse all of Gaza. And obviously saying much of the same with the West Bank. But if someone said, you know, just openly, we need to simply expel 100,000 Palestinians so that we have less non-Jews in our country, which is exactly here what David Ben-Gurion was saying, right? They would correctly be called out. I don't even have the words for it. As just
they'd be made a pariah, because nobody really speaks like that. Basically,
it's supremacy. It's racial supremacy, you know, at its bone. And if someone said this in the context of, for example, the US or the UK, where I want, you know, we need to expel black people just so we have less non-whites in this country, they would be banned. They could certainly be, you know, face a risk of imprisonment or, you know, vile hate speech. They'd very much be in the likes of the KKK in the US or the English Defense League here in the UK. And so, and yet this has been parroted not only by today's Israeli leaders, but also by the founding leaders of Zionism and essentially by all leaders in between, which we'll get to those guys.
So I guess the next logical question would then be, did this talk of ethnic cleansing and removal of Palestinians from their lands, or how did it, what did it lead to? We know obviously now that Palestinians have been subtly expelled through kibbutz colonialism, as you've spoken about, but did anything else kind of help lead to this partition of Palestinian land and then, of course, the subsequent Nakba?
What had happened in those 10 years as well is World War II and obviously the horrifying events of the Holocaust. And that was important, I'd say, in three key ways. The first way is it increased desperation of the Zionist movements to accelerate the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine by any means necessary, no matter what it took to do against the Palestinians, because of the increase of persecution they'd seen in Europe, namely by Germany, Nazi Germany. And so they're more committed now to ethnic cleansing. Very disturbingly, the war, not just the Holocaust, but also, you know, other events in the war, such as in Eastern Europe and in Poland, what Germany did in Poland, they actually provided precedents and models to the Zionist movement for what transfer, quote unquote, you know, population transfer can look like. And this isn't some conspiracy theory. You know, this is actually very much championed by an Israeli historian called Benny Morris, who isn't just Israeli, but he's very much anti-Palestinian. He's very much right-wing. He has dedicated his life to documenting the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, but not because he cares about Palestinians, but to do it in order to justify it, actually. He said, essentially, this did happen, but we shouldn't be apologetic for it because he believes that it was justified, which is absolutely mental. And so this is coming from him himself. It provided actual precedence for what it looks like to forcibly and violently transfer entire populations. And the third way it impacted Palestine, the third way that World War II impacted it, was by weakening the British Empire. And, you know, slowly the British started, you know, letting go of colonies and countries around the world, as we saw, you know, from India to Africa to across Asia, this was happening. And Palestine was no different. The British wanted to get out of Palestine. You know, India had just been liberated. They had no reason to maintain such a direct and costly foothold, especially after a very costly world war. And so in 1947, Britain had given the UN the mess of figuring out how to achieve a compromise between the people who want to colonize and the people who don't want to be colonized. An impossible compromise, of course. You can't compromise on things, on how much you want to be colonized. And the UN, they made it two plans. One plan was establishing a secular democratic state where everyone will be equal citizens, no matter what their ethnicity or religion was. Or you cut up the land into Swiss cheese, and you can literally look at a map. It was divided into, I believe, around six different territories that weren't really contiguous at all. That included giving around a third of the population a majority of the land, including much of the arable land and, you know, access to the coast and the sea. And if you couldn't tell which group I'm talking about, it was the Zionist movement. It was the settler population. The Palestinians obviously said no when the UN somehow chose partition plan, and instead of, you know, a democratic secular state where everyone's equal, the Palestinians obviously said no. But the Zionists said yes, not as a permanent solution, but simply because it multiplied how much land they had before 1947 by 10, right? So before, you know, in 1946, they had roughly 6% of the land under their control of Palestine. 1947 partition plan said, listen, you can have around 60% of it. Now that's multiplying it by 10. So they're like, listen, this is a temporary stepping stone to redeeming all of Palestine. And those are their words exactly, redeeming Palestine in its entirety. That's direct quotes. And so they were very public about it. It was very unapologetic. It's not at all this faction, you know, a small group of Zionists who believed in that. But no, they adopted it as a temporary stone, a stepping stone to all of Palestine.
But it was also, I guess, a bit of a facade to the international community, where in terms of like harboring support from the international community for a final solution, because obviously in the UN you vote on everything, each country has a vote. The Zionists recognized very early on that if they sort of came across as very willing to compromise and very sort of outgoing to the international community, just being very thankful, because obviously it being just after the Holocaust, they knew that they could get a lot of concessions again from this weaponization of the Holocaust, like we spoke about, or of anti-Semitism, like we spoke about before. And so they knew that if they can sort of pretend as if they're game to what was going on, then they will be favored by the international community, especially when you compare that to the not only the Palestinian population, but the entire Arab world. So I guess with all of that combined now with kind of the nations of the world voting in the United Nations for this partition, how did it then kind of develop into, I mean, we've touched on it a bit already, the Nakba, which was the great Palestinian catastrophe, so to say.
Absolutely. So it was in late 1947, very shortly after the failed agreement on a plan that multiplied Zionist land possession and colonial land possession by 10 in Palestine. And that was very much understood by the Palestinians to only be one further step in the colonization of Palestine until all of it is colonized. Right after, it started what we call the Nakba. And I want everyone listening to understand that the Nakba is the single most important part of the history to understand. If you don't understand the Nakba, you simply won't understand anything that's happening in Palestine since, or is happening right now, or that will happen in the future. The Nakba, you know, as Alejandro said, it's Arabic for the catastrophe. Because within the span of a year and a half, roughly 80% of Palestine was violently colonized. That 80% is technically 78%, if you want to be really precise. Within those lands, 80% of all Palestinians who lived there had been ethnically cleansed. They were no longer there. They were now refugees in other countries, in other areas, under other countries' control. Over 500 villages, towns, and cities were destroyed and depopulated and ethnically cleansed. And up to 155 massacres were committed, separate different massacres. And, you know, almost every Palestinian has a story from the Nakba, their family. I'm not going to launch into my story myself, but my family was forced, part of my family was forced out of our home in Khalid, a village on the Mediterranean coast that was completely destroyed and annihilated. And since then, they built the settlement of Netanya on it. It's just north of what is now called Tel Aviv. And the other part of my family fled from our home in Ramle, because, you know, a few days after the Zionist militias took over, because they saw what was happening to other Palestinians under their control.
I think part of how everything developed into what it did into this huge mass expulsion of Palestinians was because of the brutality that the Israelis were subjugating Palestinians to. And from that, Palestinians would hear from nearby villages, oh, that village has fallen and they are killing every single person there. Like, if we don't leave now, we will get killed. And that's also like a big, it wasn't only that the Israelis came with their weapons and said, leave.
Mm-hmm.
These rumors of massacres of entire villages, the most famous one being Deir Yassin in west of Jerusalem, this terrified the Palestinian population, and as a result, many of them did have to flee.
You know, before I get into the details of how, well, actually, maybe no, it's good to start, you know, getting into how the Nakba happened. More essentially, to summarize it, in the first six months of the Nakba, there was no 1948 war, which is what a lot of people used to refer to the Nakba as. You know, they'd only focus on the war between Israel and the other Arab states like Jordan, Egypt, Syria, etc. And we'll touch on that. But really, what's important to understand is that the Nakba started 6 months before. And actually, by the time that the war broke out between Israel and these other Arab states, roughly 300,000 Palestinians had already been ethnically cleansed. Right, which is a staggering number. 300,000 Palestinians expelled from their homes taken over, their villages, you know, frequently massacred. And that was because the Zionist movement essentially understood that it was kind of now or never. It started with small violence, small attacks between the Zionist, by the Zionist movement on Palestinian communities. And obviously these Palestinian communities that had just accepted, they formed their own resistance groups, their own defense groups. And, you know, they started retaliating, and it just kept escalating, because with each Palestinian retaliation, it was used by the Zionists as a pretext for even more violence. And in the course of those 6 months, until May 1948, 300,000 Palestinians were expelled. And the Zionists kept conquering more and more of Palestine.
Just to jump in case you're wondering how this was all achieved, again, we need to bring back what we've already spoken about during the time, during the British Mandate, where there was just a complete imbalance or a complete differential treatment in how the British allowed Palestinians and Zionists to live. And so, of course, during this entire time, during the mandate, the Zionists were developing militarily as well, which is why they basically rolled over the Palestinian population during the Nakba in 1948.
Absolutely. The Palestinians not only were prevented from being able to, you know, develop means to defend themselves and to resist this colonization and to, you know, dismantle all these colonies, they're very much violently punished for even attempting to. As I said, in the 1936 to 39 revolution, 10% of the adult male population was killed, injured, imprisoned, or exiled, which is a staggering number that really shows you how bad the crackdown was. But point is, so what changed after those 6 months? Well, what changed is that the British control of Palestine ended. The British had said that, listen, May 14, 1948, we're leaving Palestine and we don't care what happens, right? It's not our responsibility anymore, which is such a crazy thing to say. But regardless, that was the case. And so right after the British departed, they packed up their bags and they left, the Zionist movement declared the establishment of the State of Israel. And at the same time, the Arab states, Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, and Lebanon, namely, but also Iraq, and there were small backup forces from other countries, they were under increasing public pressure from their populations to step in and stop the colonization of Palestine. But also, there were also selfish reasons for every Arab state. Namely, for example, Jordan and Egypt were competing in a regional rivalry for who would be a regional, you know, power. And so they were worried that one would use their success to expand to defeat the other. And so they both enter this very uneasy alliance where, you know, they did have this common enemy of the Zionist movement, but they very much did have their own agendas. And those agendas are partly why the Arab coalition in 1948 has been called the most disorganized and incompetent military alliance in modern history. They obviously dismally failed against the Israeli military, which had been bolstered and trained by the British for decades at this point. Not only did they dismally fail by 1949 when the war ended, and Israel ended up taking over, as we said, roughly 80% of Palestine and expelling massive, unfathomable numbers of Palestinians, they also failed because they actually had fewer troops. And that's just one little thing I want to highlight. People have this weird perception of the 1948 war where Israel is a victim, right? It's a David and Goliath situation where a tiny little Israel is being surrounded by all these very hostile Arab states, which I want to say there is also definitely some Orientalism, you know, masses of dark savages threatening us all around us type of rhetoric. But it's not even the least problematic thing that Israel did at the moment. So we're not even going to concern ourselves with that. At its peak, the Israelis had 90,000 troops, but at their peak, the Arab states had a combined 30,000 rough troops. And so the Israelis actually outnumbered all the Arab states, Arab soldiers, 3-1. And they also outgunned them after they received arms shipments that the Arabs weren't allowed to receive, which, well, I'm not going to get into the deal, but point is, they certainly weren't the victims, and it certainly wasn't far-fetched that they would win it all. But what I really want people to understand is that the 1948 war and the Nakba are two separate events and processes, even if they are interrelated. The 1948 war was strictly a military war between the Israeli military on one hand and the militaries of various Arab states, namely Egypt, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. The Nakba, on the other hand, which started 6 months before the 1948 war, was a process of ethnic cleansing and an attempt to annihilate Palestinian civilization and identity. So there simply was no longer such a thing called Palestine. And that's one thing that I really want to drive home. More people correctly understand this as ethnic cleansing, which is true. But it was more than ethnic cleansing, because they weren't simply trying to kick people out. They're also trying to destroy this entire civilization and culture and country that had evolved and developed across hundreds or thousands of years. And that's why we see that the Israelis have renamed virtually every single Palestinian community, right? That's why my village isn't called Umm Khaled anymore. There is a settlement called Netanya there.
When you hear a lot of about a lot of what went on during this time period, I mean, there's a few documentaries that have come out where they interview sorts of people who soldiers at the time, basically, and they would very openly say and smile and laugh as they say that they would kill and torture and sexually assault, like, basically everybody. Nobody was spared from these Palestinian people. I just want to really drill in this idea of how terrifying and how awful this event was, especially when you, I mean, you told your story. Amplify that story for one family times I don't even know how many. I mean, obviously, the numbers, we'll never find out the total amount of people who were displaced in the Nakba, but it's estimated up to 1 million people. So just really try to begin to comprehend exactly how big a scale this entire operation of ethnic cleansing and as you said, annihilation was.
Yeah, no, it was huge scale, up to 1 million people. All these, you know, the birth of the Palestinian refugees who, you know, largely fled to Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and also the West Bank, which had now come under Jordan control. And in fact, that's what the West Bank is. The West Bank isn't like some historic entity. All that the West Bank is the land that Jordan managed to capture that Israel fails to. And also, Palestinian refugees also fled to the Gaza Strip, which was also created in the, you know, in the fire of the Nakba, because it was the only Palestinian territory that Egypt managed to capture and prevent Israel from capturing. And all these Palestinian refugees fled to all these territories. And that's when we see the beginning of what makes Gaza Gaza, because these refugees essentially quadrupled Gaza's population. And that's why, till today, almost 80% of everyone in Gaza is actually a refugee. And they're not actually from Gaza. They're from the rest of Palestine that Israel has colonized. One in three of all refugees in the world expelled from, who are no longer in their home country, are in fact Palestinian. One in three, which is a crazy number. And something many people don't even know is that there were this up to one, you know, there was this roughly 800,000 Palestinians who were expelled from what became the Israeli state established on stolen Palestinian land. But then 20% of the Palestinians who were expelled from their homes actually remained within the borders of the so-called state of Israel. And they were given Israeli citizenship. They were essentially, they were internally displaced. And what's really messed up is that they're not even allowed to return to their original homes within, you know, the so-called state of Israel, within the heartland, the Palestinian heartland, the 1948 territories, which is how Palestinians refer to this area. And so you have some Palestinians who live a 20-minute car drive away from their original homes, closer than even their workplace or their university where they study. But the Israeli government very violently prevents them from ever returning. And if they do, they're forcibly expelled, even if that land is today empty and completely unused. And that's all part of this attempt to sever the historical and cultural ties and the identity of the Palestinian people.
So just to finish off the point and kind of this section about the Nakba, what's important to remember is that this all happened so quickly that, of course, the majority of Palestinians didn't really understand the scale of what was happening. I mean, many left with their house keys. Incidentally, many families still have today the keys to their old homes that are now being occupied by maybe some random family from Brooklyn or from Poland. But these keys have now actually become a symbol for the right of return for Palestinian refugees. But anyway, people at the time thought that this was just going to be a short-term thing and that they would be able to return to their homes as soon as the war was over or as soon as the Arab armies would take over once again. As we know now, this of course never happened, and Israel to this day refuses their return, which is against international law. But Fadis, let me now ask you how the situation evolved after the Nakba. What did this time period look like for Palestinians?
So what began to happen was, I think we should touch on two things. First of all, what was Israel doing? And then what were the Arabs doing? And then what the Palestinians were doing? So three things, actually, sorry. What Israel did, it had just emerged in 1949, having colonized much more territory than it had imagined, and much more territory than was even allocated to it in the 1947 partition plan by the UN. And what they did was they were like, okay, well, we need to consolidate this. And so they started expanding their Jewish colonies. They started attracting even more settlers from around the world because, you know, if the listener hasn't clocked it yet, or if you haven't said it clearly enough, if you were Jewish, no matter where you are in the world, no matter if you were, you know, a native Jewish Iraqi, a native Jewish Frenchman, a native Jewish Algerian, you were not only allowed, but you were very actively and coercively actually encouraged to come settle in Palestine and automatically gain Israeli citizenship. And so in 1948, we had essentially the formal establishment of an apartheid regime where the Jewish Israelis had complete and full civil and political rights. If you were Jewish, you could automatically gain Israeli citizenship and all the rights that came under it. And you were governed by, this is very important, you were governed by a civilian government, a normal government, as there is in most countries in the world. But if you were Palestinian, obviously, aside from, I'm not talking about the Palestinians who have been expelled, I'm talking about the minority of Palestinians who survived the Nakba. They were actually immediately placed under a military government. And essentially what that meant is if that you had Jewish settlement, like Tel Aviv, and then a 15-minute drive away, you had the Palestinian city of Ramla. One of them was governed by a normal civilian government, normal police force, normal laws and regulations. The other one was governed by a military regime under martial law. It had very strict curfews. And if you were ever, for example, outside of your home or outside of a certain area, past a curfew at night, you would be shot at, like very, you know, and killed with the intention of killing. That happened several times. Even though these Palestinians had Israeli citizenship, they were essentially governed by a completely different regime and set of laws, exclusively on the basis of their racial and ethnic background.
I just wanted to quickly touch on this, on the point that you mentioned of kind of the Israeli state encouraging Jewish people around the world to return, as they say, or to simply go and become a colonizer in Palestine. What's often spoken about is mass anti-Semitism within Arab countries, and because actually a large population of Israel is actually, or they come from Arabic countries, Jewish people from Arabic countries. And often what's spoken about is unbelievably high levels of anti-Semitism. And so often it's spoken about that the local people that weren't Jewish in Morocco, in Iraq, and in Algeria, for example, that they attack Jewish people, they attack Jewish businesses to try and get them to go to Israel. But as more comes out, as we've seen from historians such as Avi Shlaim, who is an Iraqi Jewish person, the more that he finds out about everything, the more he goes through the archives, the more he learns about what life was like in Iraq, for example, during these times, the more comes out that these were actually covert operations by Mossad, which, for those of you who don't know, is the Israeli intelligence, in an attempt to make life for Jewish people abroad more difficult so that they would come and migrate into Israel.
Exactly, absolutely. And I do want to clarify that we're not saying that it was solely the fault of the Mossad and the Israeli government. There was very real anti-Semitism, and many Arab governments did persecute and very horribly mistreat their Jewish populations. It's simply to shed light on the fact that the Israeli government not only benefited from this anti-Semitism, but was a very active participant in fostering it or even manufacturing it in certain incidents. So that's what was happening on the Israeli side, consolidating an apartheid regime. That's fun. On the side of the Arab states, and I'm not going to touch on this very much because we are laser focused on Palestine and all the politics of the entire region, but essentially there was this buildup of the idea called pan-Arabism, that all Arab countries are, in fact, one country and all Arabs are one people, and Palestine was an essential part of that. And so they needed to free Palestine. And from 1949 to 1967, during this period, the Arab governments very much took up the mantle and the leadership of trying to free Palestine. And again, like we touched on earlier, some of the reasons for a lot of these governments was very much self-interested, not out of the welfare of Palestinians. That's, again, a topic for another time. But what is significant about that is what it meant was happening to the Palestinian people themselves. Essentially, up until the 60s, the Palestinians were very much leaderless, right? The Palestinians, newly created refugee population, their entire lives had just been uprooted and transformed into an absolute nightmare. They were still struggling to survive and recover from this. And so in the next 15 years, until the early to mid 60s, the Palestinians were essentially marginalized not only by the Israelis, but also by many other Arab governments, unable to establish their own institutions, their own leadership, and be the leaders of their own struggle. That started to change in the mid-60s when the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, was founded. The Palestine Liberation Organization said, listen, we're a coalition, we're an umbrella organization of different Palestinian factions, basically different Palestinian political parties, with our united aim being to liberate Palestine in its entirety. And in their early days, they were still weak. When they really got their chance was in 1967. Because in 1967, Israel launched the 1967 war, where it conquered and occupied and it invaded the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, the Golan Heights, which is a Syrian territory that many people have completely even forgotten about, that it's an occupied territory, till today, in fact. And also the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt, which was eventually returned, and we'll get to it in a sec. It was a stunning, shocking victory for the Zionist movement and a crushing defeat to the Arab governments.
I just want to ask about that, because it's often spoken, the Six-Day War, as we're talking about, it's often spoken about as if it was this defensive war from the Israelis. I just wanted maybe to get into that and probably dispel those myths.
It's a great question. It wasn't at all. It was launched by Israel. They designated it as a preemptive strike because at the time they claimed that Egypt had been planning to go to war. We now today know that that wasn't true at all. There was clear Egyptian and Soviet intelligence, for example, that showed that Egypt wasn't planning on starting a war, and that the Israelis even had access to that Soviet intelligence and that they knew it, and that Egypt, in fact, wasn't planning on doing it, which is why they were absolutely crushed in those 6 days, because they weren't prepared for war, right? If you're prepared for war, even if the other person launches it first, but if you had been planning to launch it, I don't think you'd be, crushed in 6 days. But that's exactly what happened.
And I think also we'll get into this now, but I think that's further proof of this is simply the fact that the fact that Israel began the occupation of not only the Golan Heights, but the West Bank and Gaza, the fact they didn't sort of give it back, if they were inherently sort of, if this was inherently defensive, they would return to how it was in the past. But this, here they came to occupy more land. And I mean, in the case of all of them, apart from the Sinai Peninsula, they are still there today.
Absolutely. And in fact, not only did they not give it back, right after the war ended, which was called the Nakba in Arabic, to refer to the setback, but in a very humiliating connotation. Not only did they not give it back, Alejandro, they immediately started settling it. Colonies immediately started popping up in the West Bank, in Gaza, in the Sinai Peninsula, and in the Golan Heights. So even the Sinai Peninsula, which has since been returned to Egypt, and we will touch on that, they didn't spare a moment in beginning to establish colonies. Colonies that did have to be, you know, of course, and thankfully dismantled. But it just really does show the expansionist nature of the Zionist movement.
Absolutely. And I think also important to mention here, as we kind of also conclude this section, was that this Nakba war was just another excuse for Israel to expel more Palestinians. I think in this case, it was around 300,000 Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza who were expelled. These people obviously became refugees instantly, and like the people who were expelled in the Nakba, under no circumstances could they actually return home. Even in some cases, people who were, for example, away during that time period, whether they were studying abroad or even to some extent on holiday, from one moment to the next, they were no longer allowed to return to the place they had lived in their whole lives. But again, this is just another example as to how Israelis over time have just been able to develop at the expense of Palestinians, most notably here militarily. Whilst Palestinians were leaderless and a disjunct state, Israel was allowed to develop with the support from Europe and generally the West. And as I just said, all this Israeli development has always come at the expense of Palestinians and Palestine. But I guess now we can maybe move on to the next section. And the question I want to ask you, Ferdis, is what were the key effects of the Nakba?
What I would say is that from 1967, from the Nakba, the 1967 war and invasion, three really important developments happened that persist till today, that we still see fundamentally shaping what's happening today. The first one is the complete colonization of Palestine by Israel. And that effectively meant, not only did that, you know, is that where the settlements in the West Bank come from today, for example, you know, those started in 1967. But what it also meant is essentially, in a very insidious way, reuniting Palestine. And so now the Palestinians in the West Bank and the Palestinians in the heartland who survived the Nakba and were given Israeli citizenship against their will, they could now kind of reconnect and try to establish a form of shared struggle. And that's allowed till today the rise of this Palestinian movement across all these different territories that are fighting for one main goal, which is Palestinian freedom everywhere. The second development that happened was it was actually the 1967 war that really created the U.S.-Israel relationship that we see today. So, of course, you know, the U.S. and Israel were buddies to some extent before 1967. That's absolutely true. But in 1967, when Israel really proved how powerful it was, that's when the U.S. saw it and said, you know what? We could really use these guys as allies to further our interests in the Middle East, to kind of act like a mini U.S., like a little conduit of imperialism for the region, so that we don't have to do it for ourselves. And the third major development that happened was that the Arab states and the Arab government, who had been, you know, crushingly defeated so badly, they kind of gave up the mantle of the struggle for Palestine. And who took it up? The PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, which was founded just 3 years before. And the Palestinians themselves were kind of, you know, disillusioned from this idea that the Arab states would liberate Palestine. And they kind of said, you know what? Fine. we'll do it ourselves. There's so much that we can cover. We can cover Black September, which was essentially a confrontation between the PLO and the Jordanian regime, which resulted in the PLO defeat and the expulsion of the PLO to Lebanon. And then we can also cover the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in the 80s and, you know, the Sabra and Shatila massacre, the horrific massacre there. But given that I know we don't have too much time, I'll kind of just summarize the key takeaway from this. Essentially, through the 70s and the 80s and the early 80s, the PLO was severely weakened by Israel and also by other Arab governments. And so it was first expelled from Jordan to Lebanon, and then eventually by Israel from Lebanon to Tunisia. Now, in the midst of this, something people should know is that the PLO was essentially an organization founded by Palestinian refugees who were exiled. So not by Palestinians in Palestine. Of course, you know, they had connections, they had partnerships with Palestinians in Palestine, but it was being led by those in exile and by Yasser Arafat, who was a name I can't believe I haven't even mentioned so far. But the point is that by the 80s, the PLO was severely weakened. At the same time, the Palestinian activists and organizers and leaders in Palestine, in the West Bank, in Gaza, have been kind of slowly organizing, slowly strengthening. And in 1987, when an Israeli army truck ran over and killed, it crashed into and killed four Palestinian workers in Gaza, that kind of sparked what is now called the First Intifada. And Intifada here means basically, you know, a mass uprising, a mass shake to shake off the Israeli occupation. That's actually the root of the word. And the Palestinians essentially across Palestine said, you know what, we're tired of waiting, tired of all these years of occupation, second-class citizenship. They didn't even have citizenship, subhuman treatment, essentially. We're going to rise up and we're going to protest. And the PLO was actually quite shocked by it. They didn't see it coming. And so were Israel and the U.S., which expected and thought that it was sustainable to occupy millions of people in the long term. And 1987, the First Intifada really changed that. So the First Intifada was this mass uprising that spanned several years, some say until 1991, some say until 93. It was vast majority peaceful. It focused on creating economic self-reliance, so not relying on Israel, boycotting Israeli goods, all these different things. And another thing that started happening in 1987 was Hamas. Hamas emerged in the First Intifada when it essentially believed that, you know, it saw everyone, all this mass uprising that, as I said, was largely peaceful. But then when they witnessed the violent Israeli crackdown on it, in fact, Rabin, who became the Israeli prime minister and who was a minister at the time, during the First Intifada, he was called the breaker of bones because he had ordered Israeli soldiers to break the bones of all the protesters, the peaceful protesters. And so Hamas saw that, the leaders who eventually established Hamas, they saw that. They're like, okay, you know what? The peaceful tactics are not working. We need armed resistance. That's a necessary tool and component to liberate our lands and to free our country from the occupation. That's what the Algerians did. That's what the Vietnamese did. That's what the South Africans did. You know, our case is no different. And this time we're going to do it from Palestine itself rather than as the PLO had been doing it from Lebanon or Jordan or Egypt.
So then how would you say the rise of Hamas and generally the Intifada, how did this affect Israel and the US?
The First Intifada forced Israel and the U.S. to reassess their strategy with the Palestinians. And the Israeli leadership slowly began to accept this idea of giving Palestinians a degree of autonomy. Now, I want to be really careful here. If you listen to a lot of other podcasts or news channels, what they will tell you is this pressured Israel to accept a two-state solution or to move towards a two-state solution. That's not accurate. That's not the case at all. The Israeli thinking wasn't at all to establish an independent Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. What it really was to set up a model of limited Palestinian autonomy so that it can appease the Palestinians to an extent and also make the occupation weaker. So, you know, instead of Israeli soldiers having to patrol, you know, certain major Palestinian cities, the Palestinians can do it instead. But obviously, they need to make sure that the Palestinians couldn't turn against the Israelis. And so, in 1991, they started this process with the PLO, which, as I said, had been severely weakened over the past 20 years. And now was also a bit nervous of the challenges to leadership that it was facing from Hamas, which had now begun to emerge, and after it was established, begun to rise to prominence, and also the threats it was facing from just local organizers in the West Bank who had proved that they can launch and lead and organize a mass uprising and protests. And so when they realized they could enter an agreement with Israel and the U.S. to establish a foothold in the West Bank and Gaza, they jumped at it. And what's really shocking is that the Oslo Accords were signed by Yasser Arafat, at least the first round of the Oslo Accords were signed by Yasser Arafat, despite not even having a proper translator on hand. That's how desperate he was. And he did it despite the very, very strong and popular rejection of these agreements by much of the rest of the Palestinian leadership and even the other negotiators, even those who did believe that they could negotiate with Israel, and also obviously by the overwhelming population.
I mean, as you said, sorry, just to interject there quickly. I mean, as you said, it was never Israel's intention to give Palestinians their own sort of autonomy and their own state. And that is precisely what happened in the Oslo Accords, where the Palestinians, the PLO, had to recognize Israel as a legitimate state, but in return, Israel would be on the way to recognizing Palestine as a legitimate state, which was, I mean, as we know now, it was never going to happen anyway. But another point that I just want to make quickly, just to make it very clear, because, well, Oslo was rejected by a majority of Palestinians, but just to make very clear that the reason for this is because the central part of the Palestinian struggle, the key issue for Palestinians is the right of return of all refugees, people who now live in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, or even the diaspora to some extent. And the right of return of these refugees in what was planned for in a two-state solution is really unfeasible. It's not really possible because Palestinian refugees would potentially return to the West Bank, which isn't really returning because these people come from what is now Tel Aviv, which is now Israeli land. So the alternative would be in Israel, but that would never happen because the Israelis would never allow it. And so as a result, Oslo was kind of seen as a form of surrender and kind of abandoning the central component of the Palestinian struggle. And so, as you put it, just to summarize, the Oslo Accords were very much a selfish agreement by leaders who agreed on it simply to save their own skin, I guess. But how would you say the view in Israel was?
You know, the Oslo Accords were a series of agreements. It wasn't just one deal. It was a series of agreements from 1993 to 2005, but most of them were between 93 and 95. And Israel didn't sign these Oslo Accords in support of a two-state solution. In fact, the Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin, who I'd mentioned was called the bone breaker because of what he did during the first intifada to protesters, he, until he was assassinated by an Israeli in 1995, what he had said in his last speech, in fact, to the Israeli parliament, and I'm quoting here, he expressed his support for, quote, an entity which is less than a state and which will independently run the lives of the Palestinians under its authority. If you ask them, well, what does that Palestinian state look like? They'd essentially tell you, oh, it has to be demilitarized. So essentially the Palestinians get no military, no way to defend themselves. They don't get control of their own airspace and they don't get control of their borders. And if you think about it, Well, if a state doesn't have access to all of those things, then is it really a state? And the answer is it's not. And that goes back to Rabin's idea in his final speech to the Knesset, to the Israeli parliament, where he said that he only supports an entity less than a state. And Benjamin Netanyahu himself, you know, when he was interviewed in the early years, when he still pretended to support a two-state solution, and they asked, well, what does that look like? And, you know, he described all these conditions. They'd say, well, is that really a state? And he said, call it whatever you want. That's the most we're giving. As you can imagine, the Palestinians didn't accept to be denied any form of rights within the minority of their land that had, you know, constantly been shrinking over this period as more settlements take over and as the Israelis grow even more hardline. Because the Palestinian struggle at the end of the day isn't even about a state. It's about the idea of being able to collectively belong to their land and be free in their country. And this whole debate about states, one state, two states, 50 states, whatever it is, it's just a means to an end. And the moment that this idea of statehood doesn't actually deliver Palestinian freedom, then we don't want it. And every Palestinian is very much willing to say that. And every Palestinian will tell you that if you ask them.
So what would you say are the key what was the main consequence of the failing Oslo Accords?
So to summarize the Oslo Accords, essentially, these were accords that meant to create a limited form of autonomy where the Israelis could still maintain all the control, but with fewer costs. And so the accords didn't promise a Palestinian state. They didn't recognize the Palestinian right to self-determination or to return to their homes. And they didn't even require Israel to remove any settlements, for example. It was in this light that increasing pressure mounted on Israel, where it couldn't retain as much control in Gaza anymore. And that's one of the biggest impacts from the Second Intifada. Because Israel saw, well, listen, Gaza's really tiny. Gaza's the size of Detroit or a quarter of London. We don't really care about it. It's not valuable for us as territory. It doesn't have important natural resources. At least at the time, they didn't realize there was natural gas off Gaza's coast. It doesn't have that much historical significance to us. So our, you know, Israeli voters don't care about it very much. And all it does, by having Jewish settlements in Gaza, all it does is it forces us to be mixed in with the Palestinians and risks forcing us to have to absorb them, which would completely destroy the Zionist dream and goal of having a Jewish majority. And so in 2005, based on both this ideological reason and also because of the increased success of the Palestinian resistance in Gaza, in 2005, Israel claimed that it disengaged. That's the term. And I'm not using the term withdrawal because it didn't really withdraw. It did withdraw its soldiers and its settlements from inside Gaza, although it retained a buffer zone within, you know, the edge of the Gaza Strip. And it said, well, listen, instead of controlling Gaza from the inside, we'll control it from the outside. And so in the Second Intifada, they bombed Gaza's airport. They destroyed its seaports. And then in 2005, when they, you know, so-called disengaged, they retained control of Gaza's water, of its electricity, of its airspace, of its access to the sea, of its electromagnetic sphere, of its telecommunications. And I can go on and on. But the point, and of its borders, obviously, everything that everything and everyone that goes in and out. And so what it really was a reconfiguration of how Israel controls Gaza to adapt to the increased resistance and also to its ideological needs. In light of this, and in light of the absolute dismal failure of the PLO and its leadership at the time, in 2006, the Palestinians held a round of elections. It wasn't the first round, but it was the most important round for our purposes. Because in that round, Hamas decided to run for the Palestinian parliament for the first time, for the parliament of the Palestinian Authority. And they won. So they won 44% of the votes, which is a plurality, because, you know, the votes were distributed across several different parties, not just two. So they won the more votes than anyone else, 44%. But that translated to around 55% of the seats in parliament. And so they became the majority. largely because the secular Palestinian parties failed, but because Hamas retained the goal of freeing all of Palestine and implementing the right of return for all Palestinians and not compromising on any principles that were pretty standard among all Palestinians and also amongst myself and yourself, Alejandro. But the PLO wasn't very happy with that. And so in the year between 2006 and 2007, the PLO, Israel, and the US, and to a lesser extent, the UK, they all had a very strong interest in overthrowing Hamas because, you know, Israeli interests were far more compatible with a weakened PLO that had accepted many of its demands. And that all boiled to a point where it essentially led to an attempted overthrow by the PL to overthrow Hamas, which responded by forcing out the PLO's forces in Gaza and essentially taking it over for itself. And that's when we saw a split between Gaza under Hamas's governance and the West Bank, partially under the Palestinian Authority's governance. And I say partially because 60% of it is under direct Israeli governance. It's mainly just the major cities, which make up a minority of the land.
And I guess it's at kind of this point at which the status quo kind of continued for the last 16 years, obviously, of Israeli occupation of both the West Bank and Gaza. And so this really hasn't, even though it hasn't really been in the news, kind of the everyday life, it hasn't been a period of peace. Let me make that very clear. The violence is very structural and is just very subtle and less flashy as compared to times like now when Israel just completely carpet bombs Gaza, as we've seen in the last month. But also they've done that on separate occasions, namely in 2008, 2009, 2014, 2021, even shortly last year in 2022. But anyway, that we should probably begin to conclude now. Fadis, is there one final takeaway that you want to give the listeners?
What I really want people to understand from the takeaway is that the one thing that hasn't changed since the 1880s until today is an ideological demand by the Zionist movement, and now Israel, to retain ethnic control of land and power and political systems. And since the 1880s, that has inevitably breeded resistance and frustration and anger. And none of this will change until Israel relinquishes its demand for ethnic supremacy in Palestine and to acknowledge that they don't have the right to do that. They don't have the right to steal Palestinian land, to live on Palestinian, stolen Palestinian land and to occupy it. And that simply, this is an ongoing process and not a series of isolated events. And that really, our future lies in remedying our past, which is one single ongoing process.
Well, on that note, for those of you who have made it this far, I just want to thank you quickly. I know it's been a long, long episode with a lot of detail. I have to admit, even my brain is a bit fried too. But I hope this has been helpful. I hope that you now feel that you have the basis, the history of Palestine, which, as I said at the beginning, should really help navigate discourse and generally understand our struggle as that of regaining what was stolen from us. On that note, again, thank you to the listeners and, of course, to Fadis, and we'll see you again shortly. Thank you.